Hi, I'm Jim Shear, host of 180 Degrees, a podcast brought to you by the Sustainable Energy Authority of Ireland. In this series, I talk to climate leaders about how they first connected to the urgent need for climate action. We go back to their roots and talk about their journeys, discover what drives them and what keeps them motivated. We also explore the essential ingredients required for leadership on climate action here in Ireland and how we might impact internationally. Nothing short of a societal movement is now needed to ensure a livable planet for our children and future generations. In this special episode of 180 Degrees, I talk to Dr. Dermot Tawney, an associate professor in the School of Law and Government at Dublin City University. He has played a key role in Ireland's Citizens' Assembly on climate action and in youth assemblies on biodiversity. His research focuses on climate change politics, policy and governance. We talk about these subjects in the context of momentum on climate action in Ireland, how we rank internationally, and what we all can do to help build a bigger platform for climate action. Dermot, you're so welcome to the SEAI podcast. It's great to have you.
Thanks for having me on, Jim.
Thanks for your time. We want to start just by asking you to tell us a little bit about yourself and your journey to Associate Professor in the School of Law and Government at Dublin City University.
Sure. So I started off studying politics and economics at undergrad level in UCD. That's more years ago than I'd care to remember at this stage. I went to the UK then, studied international relations, focusing on global environmental politics, and then lived briefly in Germany, back in the UK, in Finland, so around Europe. And then returned home. I grew up in Dublin and returned home then at the end of 2013. And I've been in DCU since August 2014, so 9 years at this stage.
It's a really interesting educational career. Was there something that happened before that that prompted you to get into it and got you connected to environmental issues or climate stuff in general?
Sure. Well, I had a bit of a revelation just about a month ago. I was clearing out some old childhood belongings from my mother's house. I think at age 43, she was within her rights to ask me to move my belongings out. And I came across some of my old school reports. And in my senior infant's school report from, this would have been June 1987, it had the line, "Dermot takes a special interest in environmental studies." And I have, frankly, no particular memory of that, but it was really interesting for me to look back at that and reflect it. Mrs. Boucher was the name of my senior infants teacher. My main memories were that I really liked her. She was a nice teacher, but she obviously, you know, inspired me in that direction. And so that's, if you like, the environmental side. The whole focus of my research and teaching is around environmental politics. And the politics side comes in, I guess, in a different way. I grew up in a very politically aware household. I was born actually in Belfast, and my parents were both from the north, from Northern Ireland. And you know, they had their formative years during the civil rights period, you know, in the 60s in Belfast. So they were kind of politically active and politically mobilized from a young age. And I think that fed through to their children. And so that, I guess, inspired me to study politics. And then one other, I guess, influence I'd identify from those formative years was my aunt, my mother's sister, who passed away a little over a year ago. She was a human rights lawyer in Belfast, and she devoted her life to basically fighting on behalf of, you know, the dispossessed, the marginalised in society. So she was a big influence on me as well.
What a discovery to make that it was senior infants back when it all kicked off, and it seems like a very understandable link into the politics. So could I ask you to define a couple of terms for listeners? What would you include as the politics of climate change?
Sure. Well, I guess we can understand politics as the process of making decisions together, making collective decisions. And so environmental politics, climate change politics, the politics of climate change is really about how the issue of climate change is incorporated into the political process, how we make collective decisions around climate change. And so people in my field who are interested in studying climate change politics are often interested in why political processes deal differently with climate change. Why, for example, we get different policy outputs and different policy outcomes in different countries and jurisdictions. You know, is it something about the way political institutions are set up? Is it something about the role of political parties, political leaders? Is it something about public opinion, the character of public opinion, the level of polarizations? What roles do vested interests play in particular jurisdictions? You know, is there a strong fossil fuel lobby, for example? How well organized and mobilized is civil society? So those are all the kinds of questions that people who study the politics of climate change are interested in.
One more term, how about democracy and climate change?
Sure. So democracy is a way of doing politics, a way of doing collective decision making that places primacy on the demos, on the people. But if we look around the world, we obviously see lots of different types of political systems. We see authoritarian states, we see democratic states, but it's more a spectrum rather than a set of clearly defined democracies and a set of clearly defined authoritarian states. One of the worrying trends that we've seen over the last number of years is the erosion of democracy. So there are a number of different indices that try to measure the quality of democracy across the world. And the general pattern is a steady erosion of democracy in terms of things like, you know, free media, free and fair elections, robust institutions, independence of the judiciary. So that's a worrying trend for someone like me who thinks that democracy and having democratic institutions is important. But if we scratch under the surface, there are a range of different types of institutions within democratic systems that each have different kinds of effects on the politics of climate change, about how we do decision making around climate change. So on the one hand, we have representative institutions. So these are probably the kinds of institutions that most people would think of democracy. They might think of the Dáil or the Seanad here in Ireland, Parliament. So those are the kinds of institutions that try to represent the views of the people. And I think most people, politicians included, would acknowledge that they do that imperfectly, but that's the intention. If we look here in Ireland and across Europe and elsewhere, there have also been another category of institutions. So these are new innovations trying to provide spaces for citizen participation. And I think we might come on to those later in the conversation. Then we have institutions, the kind of jargony term is non-majoritarian institutions. So these are, if you like, institutions that are not directly under the control of those representative institutions of elected officials. And in the climate space, one prominent example would be the courts. So the politicians can't tell the courts what to do, but courts are increasingly playing an important role in climate change governance through, you know, hearing challenges to climate policies in a variety of ways. Another example in this area would be climate change advisory bodies. So here in Ireland, we have the Climate Change Advisory Council, and there are similar kinds of bodies in various EU member states and also now at EU level. And then if we flip the coin and look at it from the bottom up, another important component of democracy is activism, the role of civil society and mobilization. And then one final bit of the jigsaw would be the role of the media and having a healthy, functioning and impartial media.
So it sounds like the interaction of these is the area that you've looked at and studied. Is there other functional interactions of these groups that you see any evidence of things working in a democratic sense? And on the flip side, do you think there are areas where democracy breaks down and maybe isn't always the best model for dealing with climate change in an emergency context? Are there other elements that are needed, or are we just doing it wrong? Or?
Sure. So I think it's fair to say that no country has the silver bullet. Every country around the world, some are doing it better than others, but there's no one model that we can point to and say, yes, they've cracked it. And a related point is that it's important to recognize that each country has its own political legacy, a political culture. Social scientists talk about path dependency, which is the idea that everything we do today is not predetermined, but conditioned by what we did yesterday and the day before and the day before that. And political institutions and decision-making are no different. So it can be easy to think that if one country has a type of institution that's functioning really well, we can just borrow it and kind of copy and paste into the Irish context or, you know, whatever country you happen to be looking at. It's really more complicated than that because, like I said, each country has its own kind of unique set of institutions. On the other point you raised there about the limitations of democracy, there's actually quite an extensive international literature looking at whether democracy is the best model of governance for addressing environmental challenges, addressing climate change. And there's a strand of literature that argues that democracy is getting in the way and that we need less democracy, basically, that, you know, if only people point to China often and say, you know, China has a top-down authoritarian decision-making system and that makes addressing a challenge like climate change much easier. And my perspective is that that really misses a lot of the nuances and complexities of what actually goes on under the surface in China, because a lot of what's driving the challenges around decision making is the role of vested interests of fossil fuel companies, extraction companies, heavy industries and so forth. And those political forces are present in China as well. The difference really is that we don't see it play out in the public in the way that we do in Western democratic countries. But the politics isn't as simple as we would like to think it is in China.
I think that was the reason for my question, actually. You know, when we look at what needs to happen and how urgently it needs to happen, and we have long established consultation periods or periods where people can object to planning. And I think these things were all set up for good reasons and they're certainly functional in some ways. Many would argue they take too long and they slow things down. And certainly when it comes to maybe a big technology like offshore wind, we know we need a lot of that. We know we need it really quickly. You know, my fear is that the processes that we have, the democratic process that we have established in place now, whilst they enable, you know, people to have their say, that that could lead to a timing issue. Is that something that within the democratic process we can get around, or is it something that needs to be circumvented like maybe they do in China? They need to knock out a whole suburb and rebuild it in an efficient way so it's done. And, you know, these things sound a little bit scary. But when it comes to urgency around climate, maybe some of those kind of actions are what we need, although very difficult to do and, you know, disruptive and those kinds of things.
Yeah, so there's definitely a tension there. And I don't think there's an easy answer to the challenge that you identify. It's really this tension between the need for inclusive decision making and the need for speed. There was an easy answer 20 or 30 years ago, and that was to do this in a more incremental way. And of course, you know, it's important to remind ourselves that a lot of the challenges that we're facing now are due to the fact that collectively, not just in Ireland, but around the world, we did so little for so long. And the scale of the challenges and the rapidity with which we need to roll out alternative technologies and so forth is really challenging. In terms of the decision-making processes and planning and so forth, so distinguishing between procedural justice and distributional justice and suggesting that people will be more inclined to accept outcomes that are unfavorable to them in a material sense in terms of distribution if they feel that the process that was gone through to reach those decisions was a fair process. So there are some ways of trying to mediate between those tensions, the need for inclusion versus the need for rapid decision making, but I don't think they can completely overcome them.
That's very interesting, because the initial sort of thought when you think, well, how can we make this faster, is to bring everyone along for the ride and sort of talk about the greater good. We need this infrastructure for the greater good. But are you suggesting that it's more that if there's a strong procedural process mapped out, whether it's for the greater good or not, that's not the key motivator? It's more, was it a clear process that was gone through? Was it rigorous and thorough? Or?
Well, and if people feel like their voices were heard, that they'll be more likely to accept outcomes if they feel like they were included in decision making, but that ultimately the decision, that they can see that the decision was reached through a fair and inclusive process, but nonetheless is counter to the decision that they wanted.
Got it. Okay, let's discuss a concrete example of where things are working and something that you've been involved in a lot lately, and that's citizens' assemblies on climate, and in particular, youth assemblies on climate and biodiversity. Could you share your experience and let us know what you think is working about that process?
Sure. So my entry point to citizens' assemblies generally was that I was approached in early 2017, it must have been, by Sharon Finnegan, who I think you know, Jim, who at the time was the secretary to the Citizens' Assembly that was deliberating on five different topics, including climate change. And she asked me to join the expert advisory group to the Citizens' Assembly that deliberated on climate change. And that's led me on a very exciting kind of personal and professional journey into the world of deliberative democracy. Listeners might be more familiar with that climate assembly. So I might, rather than talking in detail about that, I might talk about the more recent initiative that I was involved with, which was a children and young people's assembly on biodiversity loss. So the listeners might or might not be aware that there was a citizens' assembly that met from the middle of last year until early this year to deliberate on the question of biodiversity loss. And Minister Malcolm Noonan, the minister in the government with the responsibility for nature and biodiversity policy, felt from the start that it was important that young people would have their voices heard. And it's a feature of the way that citizens' assemblies are designed and run in Ireland that they are only, that membership is only open to those aged 18 or older. And Minister Noonan was keen that children and young people under the age of 18 would have their voices heard. And so he basically approached the academic community in Ireland, asked for volunteers to design and run a children and young people's assembly. I put up my hand, some colleagues in DCU joined me, colleagues in UCC joined the team as well. And we also drew really heavily on the experience of a Scottish woman called Katie Reid, who had run a similar children's climate assembly in Scotland that had run alongside the Scottish Adults Climate Assembly. And that was really the only precedent we could find anywhere in the world of an adult citizens' assembly and a children and young people's citizens' assembly running side by side. So it was great to get Katie on board and to be able to learn from her experience. But her experience of running that Scottish Children's Climate Assembly was during COVID. So it was a very different kind of process. It was all online. So I think it's fair to say that starting off on this journey, I had no idea what I was signing up to. It was at times the most stressful and complicated experience of my professional life, but also the most inspiring and exhilarating experience of my life. So what did it look like? First of all, we brought on board a young advisory team. So those were nine children and young people aged 8 to 16, at the time, 8 to 16 from across Ireland. They came on board to help us co-design the process. The principle being that if you want a child-friendly process, you shouldn't get a bunch of adults to design it. You know, the people who are best placed to design an inclusive participatory process for children and young people are obviously children and young people themselves. So we had a fantastic team of nine who came on board in early summer of last year, 2022. And so together we designed a two-weekend citizens' assembly for children and young people. The first weekend was in County Wicklow in Glencree Centre for Peace and Reconciliation, and the second weekend was in Killarney and Killarney House and Gardens, two stunning venues. We were blessed with good weather. It was October 2022, so you certainly can't take good weather for granted, but three of the 4 days were good weather. Listeners to the podcast might have an image in their head of what a citizens' assembly looks like. They might have seen footage on news reports from the current citizens' assembly on drugs policy that's going on, or previous ones. The adult citizens' assemblies, they've all been held in a hotel in Malahide. They are a big function room, people sitting around round tables, deliberating. They're wonderful processes, but they don't look much fun. And I don't mean that as an insult to anyone involved in those processes. I've sat at the back of the room. I think they are really engaging processes. But we were quite clear from the start that if we were going to run a successful process like this for children and young people, we would have to radically rethink how it was designed. And so the children and young people, the young advisory team, were really helpful in crafting what it looked like. So it brought together 35 children and young people. We selected the 35, mirroring the selection process for an adult citizens assembly. That's using a process called sortition, where you stratify, you select a random sample, but you stratify by important demographic characteristics. And so what you end up with is a sample that looks like a mirror image of the total population. And so we stratified by gender, ethnicity, geography, age, disability status, and urban, rural. And so we had 510 expressions of interest in total from across the country. We ended up with a representative sample of 35 children and young people aged between 7 and 17. And we just had a lot of fun with them. They were so inspiring. They were wonderful to work with. We built a program of activities that placed kind of fun and games at the centre. We had a nature walk on the afternoon of the first day in Knox Inc Wood. And we helped them to learn about both biodiversity, biodiversity loss, solutions to biodiversity, but also the importance of having their voices heard. And really importantly, then at the end of the process, so on the second day of the second weekend, our final day together, Minister Malcolm Noonan travelled to Killarney to meet with them and to receive the calls to action from the children and young people. And that was, I know from talking to them at the time and since to the children and young people, that was a really impactful part of the process. It wasn't just going through the motions. It wasn't just playing games for the sake of it or learning about biodiversity. They were interacting with a member of the Irish government who was taking seriously their calls to action. And just to, I guess, complete the loop, we are in a couple of weeks, we're going to be bringing them all back together for a 1-year reunion in Airfield Estate in a couple of weeks. And Minister Noonan has agreed to come back and meet with them again and tell them about how their calls to action have fed into national government policy making in the year since.
The minister's attendance there seems to be completely consistent with the idea of being heard, which is, you said right from the top, that was what this process is about. There's also educational elements of the process. So I understand that you were educating the young people and kids along the way. I think the same thing happens in the Citizens' Assembly, the broader one for adult people. Just quickly, what are they saying? What are the key messages coming out of maybe the latest interaction with young people? What are they calling for?
Sure. So we could spend an entire podcast talking about their calls to action, because there were actually 58 of them. And listeners, if they're interested in looking further, our final report we published on Earth Day earlier this year is available on the website, cyp-biodiversity.ie. So we grouped the 58 calls to action into 7 themes. So they were education and raising awareness, governance, energy and transport, waste and consumption, restoring and rewilding, habitat and species protection, and over-exploitation. And from those 58 calls to action, we worked with the children and young people to try and distill 6 key messages. And just to give you a flavour of what it looked like, I'll mention 3 of the 6 key messages. One was that every decision should take biodiversity into account, so that biodiversity essentially should be placed at the centre of government policy making. A second key message was that children and young people must be included in decisions made about biodiversity. So that's coming back to your point about the importance of having their voices heard. And then a third, and I find a very moving key message, was that we should treat the earth like a member of the family or a close friend, which I think is just a lovely way of capturing that kind of respect for nature that came through really, really strongly from the children and young people.
That's a beautiful vision. And yeah, obviously a lot of surveys out there as well that illustrate that young people are among the most concerned about this. And I guess the process is as much about honouring that as leading to action. Do you have a sense of, beyond the hearing and the calls to action, Is there a clear implementation of what young people are calling for and an infusion of these messages into government programs and action plans?
Sure. So that part of the story we're talking at the start of October, that part of the story is yet to be written because you're probably aware the government will shortly publish the new National Biodiversity Action Plan. But it hasn't yet been published, so we're awaiting with bated breath to see that new National Biodiversity Action Plan. I do know that Minister Noonan has been around the world telling people about the Children and Young People's Assembly, up to and including at COP15, the International UN Biodiversity Conference in Montreal late last year. In his ministerial address, he mentioned both the Adult Citizens Assembly and the Children and Young People's Assembly. In the months following our assembly, I spoke to a number of people who said, I was at an event that Minister Noonan was speaking at and nothing to do with biodiversity, but he was singing the praises of the Children and Young People's Assembly on biodiversity loss. So he was certainly, I think, very taken by the process and very impacted by the children and young people. But as I said, we await the publication of the new National Biodiversity Action Plan. One other side story is that just last week, the last week in September, we were down in Wicklow County Council meeting with Emer O'Gorman, the Chief Executive of Wicklow County Council, and Councillor Lourdes Scott, who chairs the Strategic Policy Committee in Wicklow County Council for Climate Action and Biodiversity. And we'd had a Teams, an online meeting with them back in June. And so this was an in-person meeting to present them with copies of the final report of the Children and Young People's Assembly. There was some members of the Assembly living in Wicklow, so they came along to present copies of the report. And we've been told that the Wicklow County Council is in the process of developing its climate action plan. I think it'll be out for consultation very soon, and also a new biodiversity action plan. And we were told last week that the calls to action from the Children and Young People's Assembly have fed into county level planning in Wicklow.
Great. Some early good news on the next chapter of the process. So that's encouraging to hear. In May 2019, Ireland declared a climate emergency. The Irish government, and it felt like a good day. It felt like an awakening to what's happening. You've had a look at what happened around that time, nationally and internationally. Have you seen any evidence to suggest that declaration has led to measurable outcomes? Are we acting like we're in an emergency?
I think we're acting at a greater pace and scale than we were before that. Whether we are acting at a level commensurate with an emergency, I would personally say we aren't. But I would also say that Ireland is far from unique in that regard. We saw around that time a wave, almost contagion, of climate emergencies declared by national governments at EU level, at subnational level, around Europe and around the world. And we have yet to see across many jurisdictions a level of action commensurate with the scale of emergency we're facing.
You've looked at emergency politics. What do you include in that bracket? What kinds of things would be occurring in an emergency through a political lens?
Sure. So, you know, if we think back over the last 10, 15 years of policymaking in Ireland, there are certainly two instances, possibly three, where the entire organs of the state mobilized around a collective response to a policy challenge. And so the two or possibly three that I would point to are the financial crisis and the response to the financial crisis, the recovery scheme exiting the bailout and everything that went along with that. The second I would point to is COVID, and I don't think listeners will need any reminders about that, but I think it's another clear instance where the entire apparatus of the state and also society mobilized around a collective goal. And the third one, a little bit more hesitant about mentioning, but I think on some definitions at least it would fall into the same category, would be Brexit. I think there was a really strong mobilization of the Irish state, both domestic policy making and also the diplomatic capacity of the state around the Irish state's response to Brexit.
I think all three had that increased, I guess, presentation in the public realm, in media. You couldn't go through a news report without any of those three being mentioned at the time, many times during those reports. As you said, a mobilisation of people. We saw a lot of human resources put to those issues and a lot of oversight and scrutiny and a lot of discussions besides just the news reports, you know, every chat show and whatever was talking about. We don't necessarily see the same thing for climate emergency. What's the difference?
So I think people don't perceive climate as immediately urgent as they do COVID. And I think that's understandable. With COVID, it was potentially a direct threat to your own health in the here and now. Climate change is more distant, though after the summer we've had, it's less distant than I think the general population would have once perceived it to be. There was, I think, for many years, a view in the wealthy developed countries that climate change was something that was going to happen to people distant from us in space or time. So either people in poorer, more vulnerable parts of the world and or future generations. And I think what we've witnessed over the course of the summer with, you know, extremes, particularly around Europe, but also, you know, numerous records, weather records were broken in Ireland, for example, the wettest July on record. I think that feeling that climate change is distant from us is probably less pronounced now than it was previously.
Mm-hmm. It almost seems like a race is on to get going on this on a new level before some of those disasters that we see occurring internationally already due to climate change and affecting those that can least afford to take it on. As a rich country, it seems like we're racing to get up to speed before we have to live through something here that's of the scale and that generates a reaction, which is a scary thought on one level, but a worthy mission, I guess, at the same time. Could we talk a little bit more about the link between politics and citizens a little deeper? How would you describe the current relationship between citizens and politicians when it comes to climate action, climate change?
So in a way, I think both politicians and citizens are kind of waiting for the other to go first. And it feels like we're kind of caught in this trap whereby citizens, members of the public, are expecting their politicians to lead. But politicians need to be given that signal, that, you know, that consent, that permission to enact more ambitious policies. If we think back to the kind of the policymaking process, we've moved from the phase of kind of broad, quite bland statements to really quite detailed, you know, legislation, a strong climate law here in Ireland enacted in 2021. But we haven't yet seen we've seen aspects of a step up in response, but we haven't yet seen across the board a level of response commensurate with the ambition set out in that climate change law. And I think politicians are afraid of the consequences. And so you sometimes hear people in the environmental community saying, we need our politicians to be brave and we need them to lead. And I think there's certainly merit to that argument. But I also have some sympathies for politicians who look at opinion polls where, you know, climate change is way down the list of priorities. And they're afraid of losing their seats if they take those brave policies. You know, they probably have a better understanding of what needs to be done than we give them credit for, but they don't know how to be re-elected if they take those brave decisions.
So the recent EPA study on climate change in the Irish mind, nearly 80% of citizens in Ireland aware of the issues, 85% worried about it. As I said, young people, one of the stronger cohorts there. But a recent Sunday Independent poll saying over 50% of people saying it's a problem and we're not doing enough. But in a kind of apparent contrast, only 16% identifying climate change as one of their two most important issues. So lots of messages coming from different surveys. But I guess the question is, and to get right to the action that citizens can take, what do you see as important in providing politicians with the platform when it comes to climate? What are the things that us as citizens can do to have that platform feel like it's the most important one and politicians could act in a stronger way?
Sure. So I think the most important thing that individual members of the public can do is talk to their politicians or communicate in whatever way they choose to communicate with politicians. Communicate with them about climate change. Let them know that it's a priority for you. Because you know, I think still to this day, you'll hear from a lot of politicians that climate change, if they're out canvassing door to door, climate change just doesn't come up on the doorsteps. And viewed from that lens, I think the reticence of politicians is understandable. So, yeah, talking to politicians, becoming involved in campaigns, in community groups, I think that's the most important thing. To let politicians know that if they do take the brave choices that we want them to make, that we have their backs, that they're supported.
Do you think in any way having a strong stance on climate is something of a privileged position in the context of the broader range of issues that people are dealing with at the moment? There's a cost of living crisis, there's a housing crisis. The crisis is tagged on to a lot of issues at the moment because things feel that way. There's an urgency around getting food on the table for many. And is this an area where those of us that are lucky enough to be able to care about it can and make some noise, but it's really not an issue that is primary for everybody?
No, absolutely. And that Sunday Independent poll that you were referencing, the standout issues were housing and cost of living. And then healthcare was the third most prominent issue. And climate change, as we discussed, was way down the list. And that's very understandable. You know, people are, like you say, struggling to pay bills, put food on the table. And so I think those of us who want climate change to be higher on that list of priorities need to find ways to join the dots between the different crises, because you know ultimately they're interconnected, they're not separate, they're not discrete.
I think that's been acknowledged. We've seen significant momentum in our retrofit programs, for example. Many more people are taking up grants. Government has committed the most significant pot of money ever to retrofit schemes, but in particular to low-income programs where the full cost of upgrades are paid. So there's record budgets being put in that direction. There's also a record shift in terms of the balance between spending on roads and public transport and cycling and walking opportunities. To what extent do you think addressing climate change can lead to progressive outcomes for society? Is that a clear pathway to solving more of our problems in terms of can we deal with climate change and at the same time deal with some of those wider issues?
Well, I think we have to. The risk if we address climate change in a way that disadvantages those who are already disadvantaged, we're going to result in a worse off society, less social cohesion, and ultimately less support for climate action. So I think that's really important, careful design of policies so that they're progressive rather than regressive. So I think that's important. It's been good to see also on the civil society side, a broad coalition of civil society organizations from across the spectrum mobilizing in recent years around climate action and just transition, but fair climate action and just transition. I think going back a few years, there wasn't as much connection between the environmental NGOs and NGOs in other fields. So it's good to see connections being and coalitions being built in that area.
Good signs. You've mentioned just before the momentum in terms of development of the Climate Act here in Ireland and the, you know, the Citizens Assembly, and there was a number of steps that led to that. You've explored and analysed the origins, dynamics and consequences of climate acts globally. What elements make a good climate act? What are those elements do you see in the Irish one? Is there anything missing?
So a couple of years ago, I looked at the Irish Climate Change Act once it was enacted in comparative perspective. So looking across a whole range of different characteristics around target setting, planning, policy planning processes, arrangements for coordination, arrangements for monitoring and accountability. And across the board, what I found was that the Irish climate law is strong by international standards. And what we've seen play out, I think, in the 2 years since then, which is a step up in action, but not yet consistent with the ambitions of the climate law, is an illustration of the limits of the law. You know, we can't, and I said this at the time when the climate bill was going through the legislative process, we can't expect a single piece of legislation to do all the heavy lifting for us. It can help us along the process. It can provide ways of bringing attention to climate change. It can focus the political system on climate. It can provide routes for accountability, for checking, is the government doing what it said it would do? But ultimately, we can't expect that kind of legal process. If a government really doesn't want to go in that direction, we can't expect a climate law to fundamentally change the preferences of governments, because you know, governments don't comply with the law in various ways. And if a government really doesn't want to do something, a climate law isn't going to change that.
You talked about accountability and responsibility in the context of that law. Who ultimately is accountable and held responsible? And what's the purpose of holding someone accountable to that law?
So under the climate law, it's the minister and the government are accountable. And when people think about accountability under the climate law from a legal perspective, they might be inclined to think about what happens if we miss our climate targets, the carbon budgets under the climate law. But in a way, that's too late, because greenhouse gas emissions are more or less irreversible. And so the more important thing to do is to get it right from the start, rather than penalising the government once the emissions are committed. And so from that perspective, there's a very interesting case before the courts at the moment, where Friends of the Irish Environment and community law, represented by Community Law and Mediation, are challenging last year's climate action plan in the High Court. So they're taking the government to court and basically arguing that the government has written the climate action plan in a way that's inconsistent with what they're required to do under the climate law. And I see that as a better strategy than trying to penalise the government once all the damage is done. So that kind of in advance litigation is quite important.
It makes sense to me. It doesn't help the planet if we throw a couple of people in jail for not living up to a law. So I guess the intention is to cause a step up in the level of action if that's adjudged to be not consistent with that's said in the legislation.
That's right, yeah. And in the case of the climate action plans, you know, under the law, they're required to be updated every year. So each year the government has a chance to do it better.
You mentioned that the law in of itself can't be expected to do all the heavy lifting, and there are other ingredients that need to be included in the recipe to live up to the climate challenge. What are some of those other ingredients?
So coming back to our discussion earlier, I would say the relation between the political system and the electorate is really important. And so in my view, it's not just a case of expecting our politicians to do better. It's also expecting our electorate to be clearer in the demands that they make of politicians in terms of climate. Those two bits are really, really important.
And they seem quite actionable for many of us, and you've given us some clues as to how to act there. Dermot, you were part of an independent panel of experts commissioned by Friends of the Earth here in Ireland to score the government across 9 subject areas on the implementation of climate and environmental commitments that were set out in the programme for government. What are the insights from that report, and what was the scorecard?
So this was our third time doing this scorecard assessment. Friends of the Earth approached myself and 2 other independent academic experts, Cara Gustenberg from UCD and Paul Dean from UCC, back in the summer of 2021, and asked us to do basically to mark the government's homework. And we, all three of us, are academics. So this is our, you know, our bread and butter. Our day job is grading students. But I think in the case of all three of us, it was the first time that we'd been asked to mark the homework of a government. And so we've now done it three times. And basically the way the process works is that a number of interns in UCD working under the direction of Cara Augustenberg put together what we call a compendium. So there are over 300 individual commitments in the Programme for Government from 2020 related to climate and environment in some way. And so each year this team of interns do a big data collection. Basically, they look for information online. They interview a whole load of stakeholders from across government, civil society, business, and they produce this very lengthy document. It's actually a really useful resource, not just for the scorecard, but for anyone interested in the state of policymaking on climate and environment in Ireland. Then myself and Cara and Paul, we take that as one input. We do our own research and we draw on our own expertise, and we go through category by category. We don't score all 300 plus individual commitments, but we group them into 9 categories and we come up with a score out of 10 for each of the 9 categories. So, for example, on climate, we gave them 6 out of 10. Nature and biodiversity, 6.5. We scored them much lower on water and marine. We gave them 5 out of 10, and we gave them a 4 out of 10, a bare passing grade on agriculture and forestry. And in the narrative that we associated with each of these scores, we said on agriculture and forestry that the government was flirting with failure. I have to credit Paul Dean with that I think quite nice way of capturing our view of how little or how much is left to be done in that area. One important thing to point out in respect of the whole assessment, and this is something that we get criticized for every year, is that we are scoring the government according to how well it's implementing its own stated policy platform. We're not scoring whether or not the commitments in the Programme for Government are adequate to address the scale of the challenges across climate and environment. And so each year when we do this assessment, we've faced the same criticism that we're basically letting the government set the terms of the assessment. And I think that's a reasonable criticism. We don't claim that this is the only way to score a government's progress, but we do think that it's a valid way of measuring progress. And so bringing together the scores across all of those different areas, this year we gave the government a C+, which is a could do better grade, if you like. And we said that there was cause for hope in the overall results, but no cause for celebration.
I mean, it does seem sensible to hold a government to account on their own word. And what I understand is that there are other processes to check and balance. Are those commitments in line with science or in line with Ireland's fair contribution to dealing with the climate crisis? When it comes to energy in the context of the scorecard, were there any actions that you could point to that would have led to a downward pressure on their grade and any on an upward pressure on the score?
Sure. So if we look back over the 3 years, we scored energy 6 out of 10 in 2021. We reduced that to 4 out of 10 last year. And a lot of what was going on there was around the initial response to the energy crisis. And so this year we scored it 7 out of 10. And we identified a number of different reasons for that. So the first offshore wind auction, the lowest price paid for emerging offshore wind worldwide, and the rollout of smart meters and EirGrid's future plans for shaping the grid. We welcomed all of those. So it was a kind of a number of different issues across the board.
Good to hear that there's some momentum there, and that's certainly felt in the Energy Authority where I work, and we're seeing 150% increase in people taking up the insulation grants. We're seeing EVs, the share of new sales really high. of course, we've issues there with a lot of SUVs being purchased at the same time. So there's a lot of good and bad, but there certainly is momentum that if we can build on, there's cause for hope and positivity there. And I understand the government's working now on its update to the Climate Action Plan, which will build in yet more ambition and positive action.
Just to clarify that there are other categories for transport and built environment. So some of what you were referencing there will have been captured elsewhere. That's just the way we designed the process.
It's definitely worthwhile listeners taking a look at that scorecard and understanding, and in the context of maybe those approaches that they could make to government officials and that we talked about earlier, gives them some knowledge of what's happening. We've spoken a lot about the national level, and I know you're also part of a group looking at the interface between global environmental change and governance internationally. Are there any lessons that you'd bring back from your explorations of international landscapes, the interaction of their own climate acts with some of those other ingredients that are positives that maybe we haven't got so far down the road on here in Ireland or that we could do better in?
So there are a range of different interesting examples of things going on in different countries. And so it's important to always kind of keep scanning the horizon and for academics to interact with academics in other countries, but also for policymakers and civil society to network. So, you know, if we look at the field of deliberative participation, there are lots of interesting examples of things going on around Europe and, for example, different ways of designing citizens' assemblies and also integrating them into the policy process. There are different models across Europe of climate change advisory bodies and different ways of interfacing between expert knowledge and the policy system. Like I said, I don't think any country has the silver bullet for this, but there's certainly a lot of experimentation around Europe and around the world, and it's important for us to constantly be learning from that.
It's clear we're still in a world of discovery here in terms of finding the right arrangement. Right off the bat, you said there's no one jurisdiction that's got it all right, but there's a lot of ingredients around the world that are working in different areas. So encouraged to hear you say that, really encouraged that you're one of the people looking at this in a lot of detail, and we continue to follow your work with interest. We've also had climate change and science communicators on the podcast who now I understand bridge this gap between researchers who, you know, might be in a room almost gathering dust, looking at a lot of detail, going in deep right down the mine shaft and coming out with some findings, but not necessarily be the best people to communicate them straight to policymakers, so that there's these science communicators in the middle seems to make sense. And we hold a conference on research to policymaking every year in SEAI, so we'll make sure to have you involved in future iterations of that one. We might wrap up by getting just back to the real practical stuff. Through your lens, Diarmaid, if you could give listeners two or three actions that they could take to support climate action through our political system, what would they be?
So I always think of this question of what people can do in political terms. And it's really about getting involved, getting mobilized, talking to your politicians, writing, communicating in whatever way people communicate with politicians. They really need to know that their voters care about climate change and care and that they're being watched that they're being held to account. I would also say get involved in activism, in community groups, whatever feels appropriate for an individual person. You know, for someone it might be, you know, out protesting on the street. For others, it might be involved in a community garden. But I think coming together with other people is really helpful. And because by doing that, you get a sense that other people also care about this. And I'm always reminded of the line from Greta Thunberg that if you start to act, hope is everywhere. It's very easy to sit around and despair at the state of the world and the lack of action. But really getting involved in whatever way feels appropriate for each individual person, I think, is important, both for the climate, but also for everyone's mental health.
That sounds great, very positive and very hopeful. And thanks for coming together with me today and for your time, Dr. Diarmaid Tawney. We'll follow your research with interest. Thanks again.
Thanks, Jim.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. We hope you enjoyed our conversation and it's left you in action and hopeful for our future. Please visit seai.ie/podcast for information on each of our guests this season and links to further relevant material to support you around your own climate actions or resources if you are suffering from any climate anxiety. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to 180 Degrees and rate the podcast to help us spread the word.